On Thursday, heavily armed police in Marikana, South Africa, opened fire on striking mine workers, reportedly killing 18 workers in an action reminiscent of the worst days of the apartheid regime. The miners were demanding increases in pay and faster action to improve the living and working standards for miners in a nation where poverty, unemployment, and inequality persist 18 years after the end of the apartheid system of white rule. The governing African National Congress, or ANC, which once represented the hope of equality for all South Africans, obliquely condemned the violence but refrained from criticizing the police. We're joined today from South Africa by Patrick Bond, a political economist and senior professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal School of Development Studies in Durban, where he directs the Center for Civil Society. He's the author and editor of several books, including Against Global Apartheid. He worked for the ANC government under Nelson Mandela from 1994 to 2002. Originally from Belfast, Northern Ireland, he has lived and worked in South Africa since 1990. Patrick Bond, welcome to Sounds of Dissent.
Amy, it's great to be with you and your listeners. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I wonder if we could start, if you could start by telling us what you know of the strike and the repression by police that's been reported in yesterday's New York Times. It's a rather lengthy article. The workers there were being portrayed as part of a radical upstart union called the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Workers. Can you break that out a little bit for us?
Yes, well, the murder, really a massacre at Marikani Mine, owned by Lonmin, with investments from the World Bank, that occurred on Thursday. You mentioned 18. That was the first report, but in fact, it was over 34 dead, perhaps 36. It's still unclear. But the dust settled, and all these bodies were found of the striking mine workers. And these were the rock-faced drillers, the most dangerous and high-intensity activities that you can find in a mine. These are platinum mines. Some of them are open cast, and some of them are slightly deep. And this is the largest single platinum concentration in the world, about 80% of the world's platinum, in a fairly small area from this part of South Africa, about 100 kilometers, 60 miles to the northwest of Johannesburg, the main city in the country. And this is, for Lonmin, an incredible disaster because not only has its share price fallen 5 or 8%, it's now looking at potential damage way down the road, and that would include potential investor boycotts as punishment for basically calling in the police to sort out its strike. Of course, there is the complication, very complicated politics as ever in South Africa, that the two trade unions were both unable to control those striking workers who really were what's called an illegal wildcat strike. They'd gone off the job, partly catalyzed by decision by the company to give some of the workers a sort of a bonus. And the bonuses are substantial, I mean, about $500 or so. And these are workers struggling at just under $500 a month salary. And as a result of a sense of unfairness, and also that the main union recognized by the company, which is called NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers, a very, very powerful union, the largest single union in the country, very important in the African National Congress. The deputy president of the country and the head of the African National Congress were the leaders of NUM until recently. So this is an incredible moment where the flashpoints in the society of extreme unemployment and inequality and degradation of ordinary people's lives and the suffering of these workers and their desperation comes into contact with not only a very exploitative company. When Tiny Roland used to run Lonro, it was called London and Rhodesia Company. It was called by the British Prime Minister the unacceptable face of capitalism. It was such a nasty company. And after having reformed, after they got rid of Tiny Roland in 1994, here they are back at the front line of an exceptional problem. And the problem then extends into the sphere of politics, even taking the trade union movement and the Communist Party into a position of hostility to the wildcat strike. And that wildcat strike was partly fostered by the second union, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, a new union that had sprung up because the big union was seen more or less as a sweetheart union of lawmen. It had been co-opted sufficiently. So a lot of complicated politics in this terrible tragedy may mean that we can start looking not only at the immediate problem of all of these workers who live in slum conditions and are very much underpaid, but also the larger questions of extractive industries and what they do to the earth and to the people.
I'd like to get to some of that. I wanted to ask first about Lonmin, the company you identified as being the owner of this platinum mine. Now, if I understood you correctly, that company was working or open for business in South Africa during the prior regime, during the apartheid regime. Is that correct?
Oh, sure. Well, look, Lonmin and, of course, Anglo is the other very big one. There's a third huge platinum company called Implats. And these are, of course, rooted in apartheid and not just active in making profits and giving money to the apartheid regime, but actually responsible with their parent companies for migrant labor, the very core of political economy in this part of the world, where the workers would come for 11 months of the year, and they'd work in these terrible conditions, many taking home HIV because of the distance from their wives. They'll have girlfriends, and they'll contract HIV and spread HIV, and then there's, of course, silicosis, a terrible disease that is afflicting them into their retirement, and tuberculosis, which is running rampant. So it's for public health, for worker safety and health, many deaths, six deaths at Lonmin this year already. These are the kinds of conditions that are associated with super exploitative labor. And I might add that the gender dimension of the reproduction of labor power in these conditions is appalling. And of course, it's not just that women are the victims then of being passed on the HIV, that caregivers for sick workers or injured workers, they raise the young workers, and all of this is done in a sort of super subsidy that they give to mining capital, which in a decent, normal society, the state would take care of health insurance or would take care of raising children or pension funds. But for the very essence of the migrant labor system was women did so much of that. And now women are protesting in a very, very impressive way because it's their husbands, their breadwinners, now having just been shot en masse. Maybe we should go back to the exact scene of the crime so that the listeners know. What happened was roughly 3,000 of the mine workers who were on strike. The prior week, many of them were involved in internecine battles. Eight mine workers were killed, and then two security guards, and in addition two policemen, were hacked to death. And most of these mine workers have the traditional weapons, the knob carries, the sort of big sticks, or machetes, the pangas, as they're called here.
Yes, there's a rather compelling photograph in this New York Times article of people holding what look like machetes or giant knives. And in fact, it seems as though the violence of the police is in some ways being justified by the violence of the protesters. Maybe you could address that as well.
Indeed. Well, that's a spin because two of the cops were indeed hacked to death along with two security guards in this sort of lead-up week of growing violence. And the two unions, both losing control of this mass of workers, at the end, even AMCU, the breakaway union, saying, come on, disperse peacefully. And in fact, it seems like, from the most recent interpretations of the scene of the massacre, that many of the workers were, in fact, running away from tear gas. And they ran and found a gap where the police were putting a barbed wire and spreading it across an area near this hill where 3,000 had gathered. A group of a couple of hundred began to kind of break through and run through that, maybe fearing that if they were caught inside the barbed wire, that they would be injured by very angry police who are in this part of the world exceptionally violent and don't hesitate to shoot. We've had here in the city I live in Durban, 55 executions by a hit squad based in a police station. So there's a context in which these men were arming themselves, and they say in self-defense, these striking workers, and some of them had been involved in the murders of their fellow workers as the trade unions fought for supremacy and representation. The National Union of Mine Workers was just in the process of losing its majority So a lot was at stake in this major mine, and I'm not excusing any of what the police did by acknowledging, as you say, Lydia Polgren's report in the New York Times and the photographs certainly can demonstrate that the workers were armed. The question is, were the workers armed with guns? And since two policemen were killed, at least two guns belonging to those policemen were in the hands of the striking workers. And that's what the police say justified them using guns when this group of a couple of hundred workers ran towards them, mainly armed, as the photographs and the videos clearly indicate, just with the knob carries, these sticks, and the machetes. What would have happened had the striking workers run into the police? I think they probably were trying to run through them and run away from them, but they were, in fact, just mowed down with automatic weapon fire in a three-minute fuselage with 34 killed, 78 wounded, at least those are the current stats.
Now, just to clarify... Just to clarify for people who may have read this article, what it says is the video captured by news organizations. In that video, the police appeared to fire on a group of workers who charged towards them, but you're saying that they were, in fact, trying to escape. Is that, am I getting that right?
Well, that seems to be, yeah. The most recent interpretations, indeed, are that these were workers. We really haven't heard enough of the voices from those who were wounded in that particular run. And what we do know is that in spreading the razor wire, the police vehicles that were doing that did create a kind of panic. And then, of course, when the workers were running, trying to sort of outrun the placement of the razor wire, they ended up running towards one of the phalanxes, one of the lines of the police. And the police were panicky, and they just shot. And you can see in the video, it's white police officers saying, shoot, and then cease fire, cease fire. They were even, some of them, even in the line of shooting, meaning really you had a very undisciplined police force. Everyone's acknowledging this South African police service are full of very low-paid and ill-equipped, ill-untrained police. We do have more protests per person in South Africa, more or less. Maybe China's competitive, as they always are, but in the world. And so we do have trigger-happy police who've had a lot of experience with trying to put down protests, and then they typically will fail with tear gas. And now they're meant to only be using water cannon. Rubber bullets was also a technique, but a few of the protesters have been killed by that. So there's a lot of debate in the society already about police, and now this will really, I think, I hope at least, mean the police really have to examine what they're doing with their crowd control, because it was certainly an open massacre. And there's no evidence, by the way, that anybody fired shots from the other side. There's no evidence of any policemen wounded in this massacre. They were not being fired upon as they initially claimed, it appears.
There's a certain irony here, isn't there, with the African National Congress repressing a striking union, although, as you say, it was a wildcat strike. I wonder if you could say something about the role of the union, the singular role of the union movement in ending apartheid, and what explains the government's current, the ANC's current coziness with this company that owns the mine. There's an allegation that they're cozy with South Africa's largely white-owned business establishment.
Well, it goes back to the character of the transition. I've written a couple of million words on this, so I'm equipped with a lot of the details, but the simple story is that to do a deal where you get rid of apartheid, you need to break the white bloc, which was about 60% Afrikaners. They didn't have much capital. Some of them were big business elites, but mostly they were in the civil service or in smaller businesses. And then the smaller group of English-speaking whites, and they were the big business owners, and to kind of break through and to split that group in the mid-1980s required sanctions to put the costs up very high to white English-speaking business, so they got out of bed with the Pretoria racist Afrikaners in the government. Then, as a result, the Afrikaners had to progressively make reforms, and by 1990 release Mandela, unban the ANC and the Communist Party and the Pan-Africanist Congress. But the point is that in that period, the ANC began to do an elite transition, a deal in which their top 500 negotiators, meeting with the government's top and a big business kind of top counterpart, agreed on a liberal capitalist democracy, but particularly agreed that big business would get nearly everything it wanted. For example, they could move their capital out of the country in the mid and late 1990s, really to take away their apartheid loop forever. And that's what Anglo did, and De Beers and Old Mutual, and you might have heard of SAB Miller, which is the company from South Africa that bought Miller Beer in the U.S. And that's the context in which the ANC elites, including the mine workers, now don't forget the mine workers inspired so many of us. I was radicalized as a student in the 1980s in Philadelphia and Baltimore by the National Union of Mine Workers, the same now Sweetheart Union, when they had a heroic strike against the mining houses led by Cyril Ramaphosa. Now Ramaphosa is a major shareholder in Lawnmen, and he was attacked today by the firebrand sort of right-wing populist named Julius Malema, the former ANC Youth League leader, who was expelled for attacking the president so much. And because Cyril Ramaphosa, former mine worker leader, could be the next president, if there's a breakthrough and there's in the next big Congress, they're looking for a compromise candidate, this is a very, very damaging moment in which Julius Malema names him, with Jacob Zuma, the current president, as kind of elites who have lost touch, along with the leaders of the mine workers' union themselves, who have been, you know, very tight with the ANC. And so this is a very interesting moment because the society has to say, are we in a situation with class apartheid replacing racial apartheid? And with trade unions, as much as they've been very effective in speaking out against economic inequality recently, nevertheless being very much part and parcel. In a way, you know, you could say the AFL-CIO was corporatist, that is, in a deal with big business, big government, big labor, in the United States in the 1950s, 60s, when everybody just agreed to retain the overall structure of power in which a small fraction, a top layer of the working class gets benefits, a kind of labor aristocracy. That, I fear, is what's been unveiled, and instead of looking at this quite openly and honestly, the first reaction of many of the trade unionists is to just basically defend the police, and that's what the mine workers and even the bigger trade union federation, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, have done. It's very tragic because it could have been one of those moments when working class and poor people's unity against police violence, against lawmen, against the whole structure of power, the migrant labor system, the extractive industries, had coagulated into some overall critique, but it looks like more divisions in the working class here.
Do you have any sense of hope about any positive that might come out of this latest event?
Yeah, the convoluted nature of politics here, where working class people still have that intrinsic, understandable loyalty to the liberation movement. We won't see a break and a real liberatory politics emerge right away. But what we do see is a moment of transparency around how a big mining house comes in one of the most important minerals, especially for automobiles, and a very electricity-intensive process of mining where we're building the third and fourth largest coal-fired power plants in the world. So to me, this is a moment where the environmentalists learn a lot more about the conditions of social justice and labor rights. And we're all terribly appalled when we learn each other's critique of lawmen. But the point is the World Bank is a major investor, and with a new president who spent a lot of time there in Boston, Jim Yong Kim from Harvard Anthropology, and worked with Paul Farmer at Partners in Health. He's the president. He's going to have to confront the fact that his institution is very much implicated, has lots of fingerprints on the corpses because they were giving a greenwashing on sustainable development, HIV, AIDS, labor, women, blah, blah, blah. And that was about, approximately $150 million in commitments that they had made. We don't know quite how much they followed through with 5-6 years ago. And that's still in place. And so what will the World Bank do? What will major investors do? Should they run on lawmen? They've started that 5-6% crash in the share values. But now it's time for corporate social responsibility to put its money where its mouth is and say, well, let's examine extractive industries, this company, but the entire set of practices that lead to such exploitation, such extraordinary tensions and conflagrations, the most obvious example being a massacre, 34 dead on Thursday, but there's so much more death, destruction, decay caused by what's happening here in South Africa in the mining industry.
Thank you, Patrick Bond. I think we're going to have to end right here. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you. We'll talk again.
Okay. Hope so. That was Patrick Bond joining us from South Africa. He's a political economist and senior professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal School of Development Studies in Durban, where he directs the Center for Civil Society. He was speaking with us about the police killing of striking workers. It looks like some over 30 workers in Marikana, South Africa. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.